Okay, so I guess we can start, yeah? And tonight I am going to talk about lay people and Buddhism, and what is kind of what the how the Buddha looks at lay people and Buddhism, at lay Buddhists, how they interact with the monastic community, how they ideally practice. And the reason for this is because I gave a talk on the importance of monasticism a while ago, and so now I want to balance it out by also talking about the lay side of things as well. And after I talked about monasticism, some people thought it was too much emphasis on monasticism, so I thought maybe it's nice to kind of balance things out a little bit. And it's always a good thing to do, I think. But the reason why I did focus on monasticism before was simply because that sometimes monasticism may not be valued, perhaps, in the Western world. People think that monasticism is just some kind of ancient tradition that can be discarded. Monasticism is the bathwater rather than the baby, so chuck out the dirty bathwater and we'll keep the baby. It's like the pure Dhamma or whatever. So that was really the reason why I talked about that. But of course, when you talk about one topic, you always give a one-sided idea of things. So for that reason, I think it's important to talk about the lay side of Buddhism as well. Especially since, obviously, lay Buddhism is much larger as well than monastic Buddhism. Monastic Buddhism is only a tiny percentage of lay Buddhists in this world. But look at this Buddhist society here. I don't know how many members we have now, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 members or something. It's kind of a large Buddhist society. And many more people who are not officially members, but are kind of members by heart, almost. They kind of belong to this Buddhist society. And the number of monastics we have here is maybe altogether counted up 40 plus monastics. So like 1% or something like that. So obviously it matters enormously, the lay side of Buddhism. And one of the things that I have always found when it comes to lay people, and one of the things that I found interesting, is that as a monk, I'm often inspired by some of the lay people and how well they practice and how they live their lives. It's actually amazing. I think, you know, very often it looks to me that a lot of lay people far more inspiring than some of the monastics I know. Isn't that kind of interesting? And the reason for that, of course, is that, as always, there's only a small subset of people who really take the practice seriously. But if you have a lay person who really practices seriously, and we have some very serious practitioners here in the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, they are much better, much more wiser than the vast majority of monastics who do not take the practice of Buddhism seriously. So often I think, wow, these lay people, they are amazing. How do they do it? Juggling their job, juggling their family lives, and still practicing the Buddhist path so well. It's difficult enough to be a monk, for goodness sake. How do they do this in lay life? Wow, I'm really awe-inspired. And it's true. There's actually a lot of truth to that when I see all the goodness and the kindness, the depth of meditation sometimes that lay people have. It really is kind of, it's inspiring. So for that reason, I think it is important to consider how we can make the most out of practice as lay people, and how we should interact with the monastic community. And one of the first things is just to start with the basics. And of course, the basic idea, if you go to a traditional Buddhist country, one of the basic kind of relationships between the monastic community and the lay people, and it actually is a very important relationship, is the idea that monastics normally tend to be like the spiritual teachers, and lay people will often give material support to the monastics. That is a very kind of a limited view of Buddhism. There's much more to it than that. But that is like the basic kind of view. Basically, Buddhism would not be able to survive without both of these things. Monastic community only survives because of the generosity of lay people. So for that reason, it's actually a very important part of the relationship between monastics and lay people. Without all of these parts, Buddhism wouldn't survive. The Buddha talks about the four parisa. Parisa means like an assembly or a congregation or a grouping of people. And of course, the four parisas, they are the bhikkhus, the monks, the nuns, and the laymen and the laywomen. These are the four groupings, the four assemblies in Buddhism. And according to the Buddha, Buddhism is only complete if all those four assemblies are in existence. All four assemblies are there. All of them are kind of doing their part to keep Buddhism going. And one of the most basic ideas is this idea of lay people supporting monastics, and monastics kind of giving teaching in return. Sometimes people think that's unfair. Yeah, monks, they kind of just sit there and lay people kind of give them food and, you know, that's a bit unfair. What about, you know, shouldn't there be more to it than that? And that's kind of the point. This is just the beginning. There is much more to it than that. But it is already a very useful starting point. And I think sometimes we underestimate the actual delight, the beauty of that interaction between lay people and monastics. If you think about it in the right way, it actually is very nice and a very beautiful thing. Yeah, I must admit, when I stay in our monastery and I see all the people coming every day, and every day we have maybe, I don't know, it's very rare to have less than 20 people coming to the meal time at Bodhinyana Monastery. Sometimes 100 people, 200 people. And it's just so beautiful to see people driving all that way here, cooking food from early in the morning, bringing it to the monks. And then the Ajahn Brahm telling a few jokes, a bit of Dhamma perhaps. Have you been to Bodhinyana Monastery at the mealtime? You know what it's like, And people are enjoying themselves. They are relaxing. They're having a good time. A little bit of Dhamma and a little bit of everything coming together. And it's actually a very positive and wholesome and beautiful occasion. So some of these traditional things actually have a lot of importance and a lot of beauty in them that is very easy to forget. Even though they are just the foundations of the path, they are still very beautiful in so many ways. And you would be surprised, I think, if you knew how some of the people in this Buddhist society, what they do and how they live and the things they have done for the Buddhist society. We just had before here, we had Dennis Shepherd, he's our president, and he has been part of the Buddhist society here for, I don't know, long before I became a member of this Buddhist society. I've only been here for 25 years. That's nothing compared to some of these other people. And Dennis Shepherd has been around forever, and he's like everyone's grandfather in the Buddhist society. Are you hiding away somewhere, Dennis? Anyway, it doesn't matter. You can be there at the back somewhere. And it's such a wonderful thing to have, you know, a person like that who is always stable, always reliable, always puts the Dhamma first, always speaks in the right way, and kind of supports everybody. He upholds this Buddhist society. He's put, you know, half of his life into this blooming Buddhist society. What a wonderful thing that is, to have people like that who support the society so much. I'm talking about Dennis now simply because he happens to be our current president, and because it is a wonderful service that not only he, but many other people do as well. So this is like just one example. One of the other examples which comes to mind because it's such another beautiful example of the idea of generosity. And this is one of the ladies in this Buddhist society who a few months ago, she decided to sell all her jewelry. Sell all her jewelry so she could give a donation to the Buddhist society. And the thing is that many of these people, they are not super wealthy or anything like that. They are just ordinary people. And to be able to support the Buddhist society, the building programs, whatever it is, they're willing to sell all the jewelry and then give the donations to the Buddhist society. So inspiring. It's so beautiful when you hear things like that. Isn't that marvelous? It's like giving up something which is very dear to you to kind of further the aims of Buddhism right here in Australia. It's just so, I find it personally so inspiring and marvelous. It makes me kind of up my game a little bit when I hear other people act in this way, because it's such a beautiful thing to do. So this is the kind of things that you find right here. And I know lots and lots of stories like this here in the Buddha society. This is giving you a kind of basic idea of what happens and how this Buddha society works. Things that many of you will never have seen simply because you haven't got that overview that you have as a monk, and you see kind of everybody the way they live. So there's a lot to be said for this traditional way of doing things. The connection between the lay community and the monastic community. But as I said, it goes much, much beyond that. And one of the interesting kind of functions of the lay people Yeah, functions. I don't know if you want to. Do you want to be a function? Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the interesting functions of the lay Buddhist community is to serve as a check on the monastics. Yeah, and this is the idea here, and this is something that goes way back, all the way back to the time of the Buddha. And the idea here is that the lay community, basically, they observe the monastics and they understand, you know, where support should be given and where support should not be given. And through that, it actually is the case that lay people have an incredible power over Buddhism, yeah, over the Sangha, over the monastics, over the whole thing. You're actually in a very powerful position. You may not feel very powerful. Most of us don't feel very powerful. We kind of just do our little bit and we see what happens. But actually, it's a very powerful position, because if you withhold your support, well, the Sangha doesn't really function anymore. And that is a very important safety mechanism in Buddhism. Why? Because there's always a tendency, if you are too independent or whatever, there's always a tendency for, you know, the dark forces in the human mind, the defilements, the greed, the anger, the delusion, these kind of things. There's always a tendency for these things to take over. And you see this in monasticism, you see this in the world, you see this everywhere. And one of the ways of counteracting that is for lay people to channel their support in a wise way, where they know that Buddhism, or at least they have some inkling that Buddhism is practiced in the right way. It's very powerful, yeah? You have all this power. Were you aware of that? Yeah, just sometimes you don't know how much power you have. In fact, in one way, it could be said that lay people have more power than the monastics. What can you do as a monastic? You can't do very much. You can sit here and give a talk, and I could maybe tell you off and never be invited again. That's pretty much how far my power goes. I'm not very powerful at all. It's kind of the one power that monks have, which is interesting. And I will tell you this power now, because we're talking about power. So this, and the one power that you have as a monk or as a nun is called the overturning the bowl power. Have you heard about that power? This is the power if you have monk. If the lay people start to criticize Buddhism in a bad way, in the wrong way, then what you can do is you can refuse to accept alms from those lay people. It's called the name is you overturn the bowl, yeah? You don't actually receive alms. And this is really as far as the kind of the monk's power go. Does that sound scary to anyone? Overturn bowl? Yeah, if you're a traditional Buddhist, actually this is pretty scary. This is really, really scary. It may not sound very scary if you are kind of new to Buddhism. Yeah, overturn the bowl, what's the big deal? Yeah, okay, please, you know, carry on. But if you are a traditional Buddhist, this is kind of really serious business. And one of the interesting instances of this was in Burma recently, when the military was still in charge in Myanmar. And while they were in charge, they did all kind of bad things, yeah, like the military in power maybe tends to do. And on one occasion, the Sangha, the monastic community, decided we need to do something with the military so they don't oppress everyone, don't oppress the Sangha so much. So they decided to overturn the bowl, yeah, towards the military regime. And that was like massive in Burma. It was really a big, big thing. And the military was extremely upset. Why? Because it kind of takes away the opportunity to support the Sangha, which is that very mechanism between lay people and monasticism that makes the whole thing function. Once you take that away, they feel that the function has been taken away. Their ability to make good karma, to make good merit, has been destroyed when that happens. That is really where it comes from. But this is pretty much the only power you have as a monk over the lay people. Not all that much perhaps, but very interesting here. So as lay people, you have this power. And if you look at the history of Buddhism, and it goes back a long, long way, all the way back to the time of the Buddha, the way that this was used, yeah, and the kind of the idea, of course, is to purify Buddhism, and you withhold support when Buddhism isn't practiced properly. And this goes back a long way. One of the interesting stories that touched on this is the story of what is often called the first council in Buddhism. Council, these were historical events that are recorded in the Pali of the ancient Buddhist scriptures. And these were when the monastic community would come together to recite the teachings of the Buddha. And this story is told, and it's a very famous and well-known story. And this story is about soon after the Buddha passed away. People wanted to ensure that Buddhism survived for the future. One of those very significant and important things that Buddhism was to survive. And the monastic community felt that it was its job, its purpose, to ensure the survival of Buddhism. So all these monks, especially for the monks who were kind of in charge of this chanting business, they all came together and they recited these teachings of the Buddha. And this is how we actually still have the Buddhist teachings in the present day, because of that sort of accumulation of the suttas, of the early discourses of the Buddha from the very beginning. The Buddha laid down the foundation work. The Buddha said you should come together frequently to recite these texts. And as you do that, they will be kept for posterity. And the problems, the faults will be weeded out because you come together and chant these texts together, or you recite them together. So it's very interesting. Already that's very powerful and very interesting, because it tells us a lot about Buddhist history here, and the ability we had to actually keep these scriptures intact over the millennia, over the centuries, going from one culture to the next one. But the interesting thing happened at this particular council. And what happened was that after all the kind of reciting of the scripture was finished, then Venerable Ananda, he pipes up. Venerable Ananda was the right-hand disciple of the Buddha, and he had been there throughout the last 20 years of the Buddha's life. He had retained all of the scriptures, all of the Buddha scriptures in mind. He must have had a phenomenal memory, and that's why he was, he was in charge of reciting these things. So after everything has been finished, he pipes up and says, "Well, after the Buddha told me before he passed away that you are allowed to give up all the minor training rules." And the monks look at him. Are you sure? What are you talking about? The Buddha said you're allowed to give up all the training rules. And the Buddha said, not the Buddha, but Mother, he said we can give up all the training rules. So what does that mean, all the minor training rules? And what it means, if you know the difference between major and minor rules, it means that you keep, the monks have 227 so-called rules, this is kind of one set of rules, kind of the major rules, or whatever you want to call them, 227 rules. These are divided up into serious important rules and minor rules. The important rules number exactly 17, the last 210 are called minor rules. So it can be very tempting here to chuck out all those minor rules. We get rid of about, 90%, over 90% of the rules are kind of boom, gone in one kind of go. Makes life very simple. If you have somebody, it's very tempting to say that. The nuns, it's a very similar kind of percentage. The nuns have actually more rules than the monks. It's 310 rules. But the serious rules, again, only number about 25. So again, it's over less than 10% that would remain. Imagine the temptation to chuck them all out if the Buddha said that. But what actually happened is interesting. What happened was that the Sangha, first of all, they asked Ananda, "Well, do you know exactly what the Buddha meant by minor rules?" And I said, "No, I don't really know." It should have been obvious. You would have thought everyone would have been able to agree on that. But somehow they couldn't even agree on what were the minor and the major rules. And then Venerable Mahakasapa, Mahakasapa, one of the most famous monks at that time in the Sangha, he said, "Well, if we abandon all these rules, the Buddha has just passed away, and soon as the Buddha passes away, we abandon all these rules, what are the lay people going to say?" The lay people know our rules, they know what we're supposed to do, and if as soon as the Buddha passes away, we give them up, they're going to say, "You dodgy monks, you scallywags, here you are, your master has just gone, and the first thing you do is to abandon all your rules. Away with you, we don't want to have anything more to do with you, you dodgy monks." This is what the lay people are going to say. So they decided, out of knowing how the lay community would react to abandoning the rules, they decided to keep all the monastic rules as a consequence of that. So that was an opportunity missed, That's bad. All those rules could have just been chucked out. That's terrible. And now, missed opportunity. Now we're stuck with all these rules, so we have to live up to them. So anyway, so we can probably deal with that. But very fascinating, and it shows that from the very early times, the lay people knew the rules of the monastics. And I would also advise you to educate yourself a little bit about the rules of the monastics, because if you do, you will be able to tell which monastics are living properly and which ones are not. So if you see like a married monastic, yeah, you know, oh, wait a minute, is that right? Are you allowed to be married according to the rules? Maybe not, yeah? But if you don't know, read the rules, yeah? And it will be pretty clear that being married is not the ideal situation for a monastic, yeah? It's a little bit dodgy, as they say here. But there are more, many, many rules like that. Rules like, for example, use of money. Yeah, a monastic shouldn't really be using money. A monastic should have a very pure morality. Monastics should ideally be an example. Yeah, so if you see monks who have an immoral kind of conduct, or nuns for that matter, then of course it is a bad idea. It is not the way it should be. So this is how you can tell. And it's important to be a little bit educated about what the monks and nuns can and cannot do. And this is the way it was all the way back to the time of the Buddha. And if you are a good monk and good nun, you don't really have much to fear anyway. And it helps Buddhism to steer in the right direction. It helps people to give support where support really is due, and to take away sometimes support from where it is not so good to support. One of the other interesting things, now that we talk about the very exciting topic of monastic rules, is that right? Very exciting. But actually, anyway, whatever. The monastic, one of the interesting things is that how these monastic rules were actually laid down. How did they come to be here? And one of the most important ways that the monastic rules came to be, were laid down, was because of complaints by lay people here. Lay people will go to the Buddha and said, "Oh, venerable sir, Bante, master, these monks of yours, they are hopeless, they're just messing around." And the Buddha said, "Oh yeah, you have a point." Okay, so he called the monks and said, "Is it true that you're doing this?" Okay, rule. Okay, lay down a rule. This is how the majority of monastic rules came about. Lay people complaining about the monks and also about the nuns. Which is interesting. And the Buddha took that seriously. So if you have complaints about the monastic community, it is okay to bring it up. That's what it means. Yeah, it is okay to deal with it, because then again, sometimes you can actually weed out some of the problems in the monastic community. So this is a very important relationship between the monks and the lay community. This is how we keep Buddhism pure for the future. This is how we avoid going down the path of all kinds of defilements and problems of corruption of Buddhism. And there's so much corruption in Buddhism around the world. But to minimize that, these are the kind of procedures that are useful to keep in mind. But this is really only the beginning of the relationship between... This is really about the relationship between monks and lay people. But the lay people's practice go way, way beyond this. And one of the most interesting passages that talks about the four assemblies and talks about the practice of lay people is found in the famous Mahaparinibbana Sutta. This is the sutta that our president and the shepherd mentioned just before, yeah, which we're going to talk about on Sunday. This is like a preview, a little bit of preview of that sutta. So if this really excites you, please come on Sunday. If it doesn't excite you, then no need to come on Sunday. So what this sutta is about, Mahaparinibbana, that literally means the greater discourse on the Buddha's passing away or something like that. Yeah. And it is about the last days of the Buddha, when the Buddha travels across India and he knows that he is nearing his final days. He's getting very old and kind of fragile and all of these kind of things. Just like everyone gets old, same kind of thing happening to the Buddha. And because he knows that his end is coming very close, it's a very powerful emotional sutta. Yeah, you can imagine the Buddha is about to pass away. The greatest spiritual genius in human history is about to pass away. Imagine what that feels like. You are around at this time. It's difficult enough to lose, you know, loved ones. But imagine if you are a monk or a layperson. The Buddha has looked after you all this time and is about to die. It's a very, very powerful moment. And because it is so powerful, the Buddha realized he has to lay down the rules and the future for the monastics and the lay community. And one of these encounters, and this is probably slightly mythical, but the content, the kind of Dhamma content, is still, I think, interesting. And this is the meeting between Buddha and Mara. Mara is like the tempter figure in Buddhism. Mara is the one who wants you to indulge in the world, and so you can't get liberated and all of these kind of things. Mara is mostly the psychological thing inside, the tempter inside that draws you in the wrong direction, towards arguments and ill will and all of these kind of things. So there is this conversation between this Mara and the Buddha. And Mara comes to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, "Well, Venerable Sir, you know, when we first met a long time ago, when I was trying to distract you while you were trying to get enlightened," this is one of Mara's most important functions, to distract the Buddha-to-be before his awakening. Yeah, this is kind of one of the main functions of Mara. "Well, at that time, soon after your awakening, you said to me that I will not, I begged you to please pass away because I didn't want to have Buddhas around, because Buddhas kind of, they destroy my plans of keeping people in samsara. Don't really like Buddhas very much, Maras. Maras and Buddhas are kind of opposite forces in the world. So Mara, please pass away straight away. Please, please, you know, you are destroying my plan to control humanity." The Buddha says, "Sorry, I'm not going to pass away. I'm not going to pass away until four things are in place. And these four things are to have a strong monks community, a strong nuns community, a strong lay men's community, a strong lay women's community." Yeah? When these four communities are strong, then I will pass away. And in this Mahaparinibbana Sutta I'm talking about now, Mara comes to Buddha and says, "Well, now all of these communities are strong. Maybe it's time for you to pass away." Mara never gives up. Yeah, this is the thing about Mara, kind of really tenacious. Just like defilements tend not to give up, same thing with Mara. So the Buddha says, "Yeah, you have a point, actually. Now all the four assemblies are really strong here." So what does it mean that the four assemblies are strong? What does it mean that the lay men and lay women are stronger? And this is quite fascinating. What it means is, first of all, that you have a good grasp of the Buddhist teachings. You have listened to the Buddhist teachings, you have understood them, you have penetrated them by view, so you know what is going on. This is the first thing. Yeah. So lay people understanding the Buddhist teachings well is one of the kind of fundamental things that lay people should be doing according to this. And at the time of the Buddha, there would have been such lay people. And if you look at the history of Buddhism, some of the most interesting suttas, some of the most interesting discourses by the Buddha were actually handed down by lay people. Were you aware of that? Because usually when we think about the Buddhist discourses, they were recited by the monastics, handed on by the monastics from one generation to the next one. There is very little talk about the lay people. But there's a couple of very interesting instances in the suttas of lay people handing down discourses. One of these is where the monks are on their rains retreat. The rains retreat is a time when the monks, we have it here at Bodhinyana Monastery as well, they have it at Dhammasara Monastery, when the monks stay in the monastery. We're not supposed to go out. But there is some exceptions when you actually can go out. You can break your reins. And one of those exceptions is if a lay person knows a sutta, knows a discourse by the Buddha, and they are about to die or something, then the lay person can send a message to the monk and say, "Please come and learn this sutta from me so it doesn't get lost." And then the monks should go to that lay person, learn that discourse from the lay person, and then bring it back, and then carry it on and incorporate it into the canon, into the canonical discourses. So this is an example, where lay people are basically put on the same level of the monks as far as remembering the suttas are concerned and taking care of Buddhism for the future. This is one instance. Another instance that is very famous is a whole compilation of suttas called the Itivutaka. You heard about the Itivutaka? Some of you probably have, probably majority of you haven't, but the Itivutaka is a really nice collection full of really short suttas with a verse, often very profound suttas. The distinction between Aparisesa Nibbanadhatu and the ordinary Nibbanadhatu. Okay, don't worry too much about that, but it's an important distinction. And some of these really profound suttas are found in this collection. And this collection was collected by a lay woman. Yeah, this was she was around when the Buddha was teaching, yeah, and she remembered these discourses, and she kind of made it into a collection, I suppose, and said to the monks, "This is the collection. I will recite it for you. You carry it on." And to the present day, is known to have been collected by a lay woman from that time. Isn't that fascinating? And then that was incorporated into the body of suttas, and basically. A laywoman who wouldn't normally have had a very high status in that society, her memory of the suttas was put on par with everyone else. This is the Itivuttaka collection. So next time you read that, remember that and have a look at it. There's some very beautiful suttas in there. Another example which I find is very interesting because it inverts the relationship between lay people and monastics. That is a famous layman called Ugga the householder, Ugga Gahapati in the suttas. And Ugga Gahapati, he was this very, very advanced layperson. Yeah? One day he said to his wives, he had many wives like they had in those days, especially if you were wealthy, you would have a number of wives. Okay, you better all leave because, you know, I'm not really interested in married life anymore. So just go off and, you know, I will help you find a nice husband for you. So he sent all his wives away and found them nice husbands and everything. And they all left him except for one who wanted to be with him, even though, you know, even though kind of marriage life had changed a lot because of his insight into his teachings. This was Ugga the householder. And one day he went to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, "Well, Ugga, you are a kind of an exceptional layperson, and we hear that you have 8 amazing qualities. Would you like to tell us about your 8 amazing qualities?" And Ugga says, "Sure, I will tell you about my eight amazing qualities." And some of those qualities are like he was a non-returner. Yeah, non-returner means you're almost fully enlightened. You're kind of on the brink of full awakening. And so basically he was, you know, the similar kind of wisdom as the monastic community, even the pious people in the monastic community. He had full control over his meditation, could go into deep states of meditation on a finger snap like that. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, whatever you want. And there was a number of other amazing qualities. I can't remember them all. I haven't looked this up before I came here. So this is just years ago since I read this sutta. But the 8th quality was always stuck in my mind because it was kind of special. This is what Ugga said. You have all these lofty qualities, and it comes the 8th quality. And he says, "Well, you know, when I invite the Sangha, the monastic community to my house, which I do all the time, well, first of all, I don't discriminate among the different monastics. I treat them all exactly the same, regardless of whether they are arahants or they are ordinary people or whatever they are, even if they're just a junior novice, I treat them the same. But the second thing is that when I invite the monks to my house, I ask the monks to teach the Dhamma, teach the Buddhist teachings. And if the monks don't teach me the Dhamma, then I teach the Dhamma to the monks." So he gets up on the high seat, teaches the Dhamma to the monks. And isn't that kind of nice? Yeah, and this kind of inverts Buddhism. It turns it around. We're always used to the monastics being the teachers. And here you have a layperson teaching the monastics. And what that shows you is that it is not so important who teaches. What it shows you is that wherever there is wisdom, wherever there is understanding, wherever there is something special, that is where the teaching should come from. So, first thing, lay people should learn the teachings. Yeah, and only when they really learn those teachings fully, like they do here, then they become one of the 4 pillars, one of the 4 parisas in Buddhist society. This is the first thing that the Buddha says the laymen and laywomen at that time had fulfilled. Then, once you have learned those teachings, the second thing is then to apply them. Yeah, you use them and you practice. You practice the Dhamma in the right way. This is called Dhammanudhamma Patipatti in Pali, practicing the Dhamma in the right way. And this really means that you fulfill all the stages of the path. Yeah, all the various factors that you have to do, the virtue aspect, the meditation aspect, but also the wisdom aspect. This really means that you have become a noble person. Yeah, there were many noble lay people at that time, people who had fully penetrated these wonderful and amazing Buddhist teachings. There were lots of them at the time of the Buddha. And this is what this Dhammanudhamma Patipatti refers to, this full practice of the teachings. So you learn the teachings, you practice them fully as a lay person. Yeah, This is part of the, also part of lay life. If you want to live it fully, this can be done, says the Buddha. And ideally it should be done. Then the next one, once you have practiced the teachings well and you know them properly, you should teach them. Yeah, you should teach them to other people. You should make them clear. You should analyze them, says the Buddha. You should bring them out into the open for other people to understand. Lay people should also be teachers. Lay people should also do these things. It is actually a wonderful thing to be a teacher. One of the things that I realized when I started to teach was that you learn so much from being a teacher. Being a teacher is this wonderful gift to yourself. If somebody else are interested in listening to what you're saying, that's fine. But that's kind of, you know, if nobody was here, it'd probably still be good to teach. Yeah, teach to an empty room. Maybe a few mice crawling around. Is there mice in here? Not sure. I shouldn't say that if in case there is. But yeah, so it's actually a wonderful thing to do. And I think that one of the things that we perhaps should do also in modern Buddhism to bring back some of these early Buddhist ideas, and we should encourage also lay people to be teachers. Yeah, because it is a beautiful thing to be able to do, to teach others, and you learn so much from that. And I think in the modern day, when there is such a vast majority of lay people compared to the monks, sometimes you have to use your resources wisely. So you guys, you're all the resources of the Buddhist Society. Yeah, so if you, because you're all resources, we're going to use you. Is that okay? Can we do that? It's nice to be used sometimes if it's in the right way, because it is a positive thing and a suitable thing. So this is another, I think, important thing that you learn about these parisas. The ability to lay people also should be out there teaching, also should take part in this. And the last thing the Buddha says as part of this teaching activity, you may be surprised to hear this, but the Buddha says you should be able to refute the doctrines of others. Can you do that? You know how to refute the doctrines of others? This does not mean that we go from door to door and we knock and say, well, what religion? Are you a Christian? Okay, you're a Christian, I'm going to refute your doctrine. It doesn't mean that. Oh, you're a Muslim? Okay, I'm going to refute the Islamic doctrine. Yeah, I'm going to show you how to be a good Buddhist. That is not what it means, obviously, because that creates all kinds of problems. If you go around trying to refute everybody in the world, it creates conflict in society. What it means is that within the Buddhist community, we have an understanding of the difference between Buddhism and other teachings. We know what it is that makes Buddhism special. And because you know that, we are able, at least within ourselves, to kind of to understand that distinction and why Buddhism is different. So what is it? What is it that makes Buddhism different? Do you know? What is the difference? Have you ever considered that fully? Many people say, oh, all religions are the same. Yeah, we're all kind of heading in the right way. That is a kind of nice, feely-feely. Feels good. Yeah, it feels nice to think like that. But it's not the full picture. There is a lot of similarities between the world's religions. Yeah, there's a lot of things in the area of ethics that are similar. To love thy neighbor as yourself. What is that? Something like that. And there's lots of these things that actually are similar, yeah, in the world's religions. But there also are important differences. So what is it that is special about Buddhism? And this is kind of interesting here. And there are many, many things that makes Buddhism, in my opinion, very unique and special, and kind of it takes things too often to a new level that very often you may not find in other philosophies or other areas of life. And one of the beautiful things about Buddhism is the Buddhist idea of ethics, which is built on natural principles rather than someone laying down a law. It is built up from natural principles. And that is such a beautiful thing because it makes sense. When you hear about Buddhist ethics, if it is taught in the right way, if it is well taught, you think, yeah, this makes sense. Of course, this is what ethics really is about. It is based on natural principles of when people suffer and when they don't suffer, etc., etc., on the intention of the mind and these kind of things. So this is one area where Buddhism is a little bit different, but not really completely different, because most systems of, you know, of philosophy or psychology or religion, whatever, they have ethics to some extent, sometimes to a very large extent. So the one thing that makes Buddhism different from all other teachings is the teaching of non-self. Yeah, the idea that there is nothing inherently existing in the whole world. This is what makes Buddhism absolutely unique. And if you think about the vast majority of religions in the world, this is precisely the idea that they have. They have the idea of a creator God, yeah, some essence to the universe that is always there. You find that in Hinduism. You find that in all the Abrahamic religions. Yeah, this is something you find almost elsewhere, almost everywhere else. And of course, part of that idea of an external creator God is also the internal idea of a soul. Yeah, this permanent essence in a human being. These are mirror images of each other, the external creator God and the internal soul inside. So this is where Buddhism is unique. And this is such an important thing to understand, because the tendency in human beings is always to lean towards the idea of a permanent essence in human beings. That is what we want to see. We want to somehow exist in a certain way. And because we want to exist, we tend to see something permanent and inherent inside of us. So this is one of the most important distinctions. So if you ever, you know, come into this position where you have to kind of refute the arguments of others, that is the kind of the core principle whereby Buddhism is different from pretty much everything else you find in the world. So just for your education, I thought I might take that into it, even though it's kind of a little bit on the sideline of what we're looking at. But what this shows you is that lay people at the time of the Buddha, when the four assemblies were really powerfully established, they were incredibly erudite. These were people who really knew what they were doing. They practiced the path almost all the way to the end. They understood the idea of non-self, of anatta, anatman. They understood these things to the core. It was remarkable what could be done, yeah, on the Buddhist path by lay people. So that is the example that you should all follow, right? This is the inspiration, yeah? And lay people at that time who were inspiring were precisely this kind of lay people who had these profound insights and understanding on the path. And sometimes on the way, as you do that practice, you become maybe a monastic, some people do, but you don't have to. And even if you don't have to, you still can go a long way as a Buddhist lay person in this way. Yeah? And there are some very inspiring examples of this in the suttas. Yeah, of lay people who really had a profound appreciation of how the Buddhist path works. And just as a precursor, one of the inspiring people you can read about in the Buddhist discourses was a layman called Anuttapindika, which many of you will have heard about, some of you will have heard about anyway. Anuttapindika, he was the main patron of the Buddha, and he was the one who built up the largest Buddhist monastery in India at that time, that was found in a place called Savatthi, the capital of the Kosala kingdom. And he bought this large piece of land from a prince. This was Prince Jeta, and because this place was called the Jeta Vana. Jeta Vana. Vana means like grove or forest or whatever. This was the Jeta Grove, bought from Prince Jeta, and at the Pindika's monastery here. So he bought this monastery, and it was an incredibly important supporter to the Buddha. But of course, after a while, the Buddha realized, you know, someone like that, he needs more teachings than just teachings on generosity and kindness. He already has those pretty much sorted out. So he tells them that, you know, you too, you know, being practicing in such a good way, you should go into seclusion and enjoy the bliss of seclusion. Yeah, so if you are practicing well, if you're already doing all the right things, if you're keeping the five precepts, if you're being kind and compassionate in the world, that is the foundation. The foundation is the place. Now, when the foundation is in place, you should use that to experience the bliss of seclusion. The bliss of seclusion is the deep states of samadhi that we are moving towards when we practice meditation practice. When you practice meditation in the right way, when you are able to give up the senses and the body, give up pretty much the entire world outside, the more you give that up, the more bliss you're going to feel. Until you feel so much bliss that you think, I can't take it anymore. This is the promise of the Buddha. This is what the Buddha says to Anuttapindika. Now is your turn to feel that profound bliss because you had earned it through all the basic practices of the path. Now you should be doing the same thing. So remember that. This is there for every one of us, every one of you, to achieve. If you're living the foundations on the path in the right way, we now have beautiful monasteries here. We have this beautiful center right here. It is difficult to achieve that powerful bliss here on a Friday night. Maybe some of you had that powerful bliss. I don't know. But majority maybe not, because you're exhausted. Yeah, more likely to fall asleep than to kind of find that powerful bliss. Maybe, whatever. But the point is that we have the facilities. We have places like Jhana Grove, we have the monasteries. And seclusion now in the present day means removing yourself a little bit from your ordinary environment. Go to somewhere beautiful and peaceful like the Jhana Grove Meditation Center. Enjoy at least a weekend retreat, perhaps a longer retreat, and see if you also can enjoy that bliss of seclusion, the seclusion from the world outside, which you have earned through your hard practices of all the foundation principles of the Buddhist path. And there is another example in the suttas, which is I always found very inspiring again. And this is the example of Visakha. Visakha was the Buddha's main lay woman disciple. And she was obviously very wise, and she had understood the teachings of the Buddha in a really profound way. And at one particular occasion, Visakha went to the Buddha and she said to the Buddha, "I want to do all of these services to the Sangha. I want to be the one who, when there is a sick monk, that I can give, or a sick nun, to give a meal to the sick people." I want to be the one that when there are people who look after the sick, the upatak, so the attendants on the sick, I want to support the attendants to the sick. When there are new monks or nuns coming to Savati, which was the town where she was living, I want to look after them because they won't know where to get food, because they're new. If there are monks and nuns leaving Savati, I want to give them the last meal so they don't have to travel hungry when they travel. I also want to give a supply of rice porridge in the morning. And also I want to supply bathing cloths for the nuns. So there was a long list of things. And she says to the Buddha, "Please, can you give me this boon? Can you give me this, grant me this special privilege so I can offer these things to the Sangha?" And the Buddha replies, "Buddhas don't give special privileges." Imagine the Buddha saying that to you. "The Buddha does not grant special privileges." Okay then. And you walk away, That's what most people do, because the Buddha probably... Do you think the Buddha is scary, or do you think he's kind of not scary? Is he like a teddy bear, or is he more like a stern kind of person, like a headmaster? Probably the Buddha is not as scary as we think, In our minds, we're kind of... Oh, the Buddha's looking at me. I've got to be careful what I say. But the Buddha is probably actually quite not so scary. So Visakha, she is not so easily put off. So the Buddha asked her, "Well, what benefit do you see here that I should give you this special privilege?" And then Visakha shows her understanding of the Dhamma, of this Buddhist teachings. And she says to the Buddha, "Well, if I am allowed to give all of these things, then whenever I hear that a monk who has been here to Savati, or a nun who has been here to Savati, is enlightened, or has achieved some state of samadhi, or has achieved some special, advancement on the path, then I will know that I will have fed them at least when they came and when they left, possibly also when they were sick. Maybe I gave them rice porridge in the morning." And when I think that I supported people who have these wonderful attainments of the path, I will be joyful. And when I am joyful, I will feel this rapture inside. And when I feel the rapture inside, I will feel tranquility. The beautiful, powerful tranquility when you really calm down and you feel like a rock in your meditation practice. Then when I feel tranquility, I will feel the sukha. This is a Pali word, which means the profound happiness on the path. I will feel this profound sukha. And when I feel the profound sukha, I will have the samadhi that arises out of that. This is what Visakha told the Buddha. And this is really profound. This is actually one of the main teachings of the Buddha on the progress of meditation practice. If the foundation work is in place, if you have practiced in the right way, if you have been kind, lived with kindness and generosity in your life, you have had compassion, understanding for people, and all of these kind of things eliminated your ill will and negativity, this is the result. And she understood the result. And this is an automatic process. Yeah, this is what the Buddha says in the sutta. This just happens. If the foundation things are there, this will happen to you. And she had got this. And the Buddha says, what did he say? Sadhu? I don't think he said sadhu. Maybe he said sadhu. I can't remember now exactly what he said. He said, wow, that's really amazing that you understand this. Yeah, you have really understood these teachings. And of course, from that samadhi, that deep meditation, also comes the insight that makes you into an Aryan, a noble person. So the Buddha says, well, what can I say? If someone has such a deep appreciation of what I teach, well, I'm going to give you that special privilege. And so Visakha, by proving her understanding of the Dhamma, was able to get this very special privilege from the Buddha of supporting the Sangha in such a profound way. Why? Well, probably because the Buddha knew that she is going to be a blessing for the Buddhist community, lay women, laymen, the nuns and the monks. Yeah, for everyone, because of how she understood the Dhamma. So this is how you get things in the right way here. This is how you can see the lay community basically does exactly the same thing as the monastic community here. There's a little bit of difference maybe at the very base, at the root of how we interact. But beyond that very root interaction that we do, beyond that, the path is the same. Yeah, as a lay person, if you support the monastic community, if you do it in the right way, like Visakha did, it should give you a lot of joy and happiness. If you practice your sila, your virtue in the right way, that too will give you joy and happiness. If I come here and teach in the right way, if I don't say too much nonsense, then I too might get a bit of happiness out of teaching, feeling that I am supporting others and helping people out. And in this way, we're basically doing the same thing, but from slightly different angles. And then we build up the path from the bottom, and the path that happens in the same way for both lay people and monastics. And what is interesting, the Buddha says in one of the suttas, this is one that is called, one of the discourses called the Mahavachagotta Sutta, found in the Majjhima, middle length sayings of the Buddha, number 73, if you want to look it up. The Buddha says, or there's actually a fellow called Vachagotta who says this, but obviously the Buddha agreed, and that's why it is there. And the Buddha says in there that it is not just that we have one or a few arahants among the monastics, we have many more. It is not just that we have one or a few highly attained lay people. They may not have been arahants, but they were very, very close to full enlightenment. But we have hundreds and hundreds of lay men and lay women who have attained all these beautiful, profound states of meditation and insight. And if it hadn't been the case that this was true, if all of these lay people didn't attain these things, then the Buddhist religion, the Buddhist teaching would not have been complete. It would not have been fulfilled. This is how you fulfill the Buddhist teaching. This is how you fulfill the parisa. This is how you fulfill what it means to be a layman and a laywoman and a monk and a nun, by attaining these things. Without it, it would not be complete. So remember that. If you want to be part of a blessing, or what it means to be a true Buddhist, take this practice very seriously, and you too will be able to attain all of these wonderful, marvelous fruits of the Buddhist path. All the happiness you ever dreamt of. Actually, far more happiness than you can possibly even conceive. That is what the Buddhist path has in store for everyone. So if you want to be part of this community, follow the Buddha's advice. Practice these teachings fully, and every one of us will become a blessing for ourselves and also for everyone else. Okay, that is the talk for tonight. Okay, wonderful, thank you very much. And are there any questions from the floor before we go interstate and overseas? Anyone want to say anything here? Nobody wants to say anything here? Okay, here. Okay, good. So in that case, you sure? Last chance? Okay, so let's move on to the questions from overseas. So the first one is from the USA, and the question is as follows. What is the Buddhist way for lay people to get rid of divisions, borders, discrimination, judgment, and learn tolerance of different cultures in the lay society here. So how do lay people get rid of these things? And there's two answers to that question. And the first one is that the world, remember, the world outside is out of control. Yeah, remember, we cannot make the world outside go according as we would like to have it. If the world outside was, if it was possible to control the world outside in that way, that we could have get rid of all discrimination, all these kind of things, it would have happened a long time ago already, because somebody would have figured out how to do it. The whole point of the Buddhist path is to understand, yeah, this is the, one of the main insights of a Buddhist, is to understand that things are precisely out of control. Things are precisely impermanent. You cannot have it the way you would like it. So when you see that there is division in the world, when you see that there is wars going on, when you see that there's all kind of problems happening around you, instead of kind of despairing too much over that, what you should do is you should say, well, this is what is to be expected. This is the way the world goes. I will never be able to get rid of all these things. So the answer is not that you should stop trying to do your best. Of course you should do your best. Of course you should help out, because when you help out, you are doing something positive and good for the world, and you will develop your own practice by doing something good. But at the same time, you should remember that you will never succeed fully. You may succeed partially, and then having succeeded partially, it may revert again back to its old problems. So lower your expectations. Don't expect anything necessarily to happen in the world at large. If you can help a few people and that can change their life, then you have already done enormous good for human society and for everyone. So this is the first part of the answer. Forget about fixing the world. The world is inherently unfixable. You can help a little bit, but you cannot fix the world. The same old problems return again and again and again. And it has to be like that. This is one of the fundamental principles of the Buddha's teachings. So learn this, and then you start to understand a little bit about what suffering really is about. And the more you get that, the more impetus you have to practice your spiritual life. The other answer to this question is that healing divisions very often means healing divisions within yourself. That is the most important division that you can heal. So you, if you can eliminate anger in your heart, if you can eliminate discrimination within yourself, if you can see all beings as suffering beings in this world and have compassion for everyone, regardless of their background, regardless of who they are, regardless of age, education, gender, whatever it might be, then you are doing the right thing. And if you can do that in your heart, then you're going to inspire so many other people to do the same thing. This is why the Buddha is so powerful. He was able to eliminate all of these defilements and problems from his own heart. And he has inspired people for 2,500 years after that. Countless of beings that have escaped from suffering and attained so much happiness because of that. Hundreds of millions of Buddhists still around the world who gain inspiration from the Buddha's teachings. And each one of us can be some of that inspiration. Follow in the Buddha's footsteps and do similar things to what the Buddha did. And if you can do that, wow, you are doing really, really well. So that should be the prime concern. Eliminate discrimination in your own heart. Purify yourself. And that is actually the best way to also change the world outside. Because people, I guarantee you, they will be inspired by you if you can live like that. Okay. Second question. What is the subtle difference between letting go and letting be, especially regarding unpleasant thoughts and painful cessations? Well, the difference is that letting be is like the initial phase of letting go. Letting be means that you don't fight it anymore. Yeah. So if you have unpleasant thoughts and painful sensations, instead of fighting those unpleasant thoughts, you like embrace them. You say, this is part of me, I have these unpleasant thoughts, and it's okay. Yeah, what do I expect? Of course I'm not going to be perfect. I have been conditioned through this life, I've been conditioned in past lives, I'm going to be imperfect. It's okay if I have these kind of negative thoughts. And there's something very interesting that happens when you think like that. Because if you don't like your unpleasant thoughts, if you push them away, it is very hard to get insight into them. Because that pushing away, it destroys the neutral ground at which insight happens. To gain insight, you have to be neutral. You have to watch things without a vested interest. But if you push them away, it's as if you have a vested interest. The neutral ground has been destroyed. And for that reason, much more difficult to get insight. So if you want to have real insight, you actually have to have the letting be idea. You let things be here. You watch all the unpleasantness, wherever is going on in your mind, you watch that. And you start to understand how it arises. And once you understand how it arises, the solution becomes very obvious. Okay, I'm upset with this person. Why am I upset with this person? Well, actually, it's because I'm thinking about them in a silly way. I think that they are bad, but they're not bad. They're just conditioned, for goodness sake. How can I be angry with all these poor, conditioned people who are acting against their own self-interest? I must have compassion for them. Letting be allows you insight into those things. And then when you have that insight, you can let go fully. Because the insight is the thing which shows you the problem very clearly. And it shows you the solution to the problem. And then you let go like that. So this is how I see you let be. Gain insight. It can sometimes very small. I'm not talking about really profound insight. I'm talking about small everyday insights that everyone can have. And then it disappears because you understand the causes. If you really understand that something is problematic, something is suffering, it disappears, bang, like that, and it's gone. Okay, enough for tonight. So let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Sipatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅgha.